Thank you everyone for coming along. It's lovely to see an audience of so many friends and esteemed scholars and new scholars. Yeah, terrific. So thank you. Now this research really started as part of the Mallelands project, the environmental history of the Southern Mallelands that I'm working on with Katie and Richard and Ruth and Charles. Although it's inevitably taken me beyond the Mallelands to the entire interior. So I think it's the inland, that's right. So I think it's appropriate to be giving this seminar in the context of the fabulous new Centre for the Study of the Inland. It is a work in progress. I feel like some of the ideas are still being digested, so feedback is very welcome. Yes, again, and thanks for the opportunity to come here and talk to you. So I'll introduce our key subject, the Australian plague locust, Chorsetoides terminifera. These are often known as grasshoppers or locusts interchangeably, and they're found throughout the inland. They're usually solitary insects, but on certain occasions they will come together and become what scientists call gregarious. So they become gregarious and they then travel. They can migrate large distances in large swarms. I've got to get my collective nouns right. Large swarms, they... When it rains in the interior, in the arid lands, this is what will trigger a kind of swarming formation. So it rains, they're able to breed. When there are several consecutive generations, they can form large populations, and these then migrate. And if they find areas where it's rained, then they can breed some more, migrate some more, and you get what has come to be called a locust plague. So locust country. As you can see, it covers a great deal of the interior, or the inland. This is, of course, just the eastern part of Australia. Now, I feel a bit odd putting up a map like this, being from the west, not including Western Australia. Today, I am going to be talking only about the eastern locust country. We do also have grasshoppers / locusts in the west, and we do have locust plagues, but they're, to some extent, a different species. Well, a lot of the locust plagues have been plagues of a different species rather than the Australian plague locust that I'm focusing on today. Also, the story I'm telling today ends with the Australian Plague Locust Commission, and this is the area in which it operates. You can see it bounded by that solid black line there, along with the Australian Plague Locust Commission bases and areas of responsibility for the other two locusts that they deal with, the spur-throated and migratory locusts. Okay, so as land was grazed and cleared, the colonists unwittingly increased locust habitat, and starting in the late 19th century, large outbreaks became more common. So I think these plagues were, to a large extent, of the colonists' own making. You can see this chart, which has been compiled by researchers at the Australian Plague Locust Commission, shows that the outbreaks are quite irregular. They're highly dependent on environmental factors. So rains in the inland followed by rains in surrounding areas that enable the locust to become gregarious and then breed and migrate. Now, thinking about the historiography of locusts and human-insect relations more generally, Ted Deveson at ANU and the Federal Department of Agriculture and Water Resources has done some really terrific work on scientific responses to locust plagues, although he situates these in the context of international ecological theory rather than the broader cultural context that I'm going to be talking about today. But still, his work has provided a really useful foundation for my own work. I've also drawn ideas from the work of environmental historian Edmund Russell, who's examined relationships between war and nature through the case study of insect pests and pesticides. And Russell argues that war and control of nature co-evolved, and each influenced the other in three main areas: the areas of ideas, materials, and organisations. And these categories have also informed my own work on locusts in the Australian context. Although Russell concluded his examination of the ideological, technological, and organisational links between chemical warfare and pest control in the 1960s, whereas I'm following similar connections in the Australian context into the 1970s and beyond. Now, environmental historians are very used to the idea of war on nature, especially in a place like the Mallelands, where settlers found the vegetation and the climate harsh and alienating, and the metaphors of war in battling the elements to produce farms and crops were ubiquitous. Here too, there were military connections, material connections rather, between war on people and war on nature. For example, with ex-military tanks being used to clear Mallee woodland in the 1950s. And here's a great example that I came across at Hyden, where somebody's even welded part of a, looks like an old tank of some sort, onto the top of it to provide cover while out there beating down the Mallee. This was actually situated in the midst of a resort on the edge of Lake Magic, which is a salt lake in the Hyden district, curiously. So what's different about the locust example is the ubiquity of connections, which to me at least were quite confronting. So here's an example of a literal war being waged against nature using the same strategies, techniques, even the same vehicles deployed in war on humans. Changes in one area influence changes in the other in really quite obvious ways. Although in the case of Australian plague locusts, the connections flowed mostly one way, from war on humans to war on locusts. So this is essentially what I'm arguing is, as such, it presents an extreme case, the case of locusts, present an extreme case of the general pattern of agricultural and pastoral colonisation of Australia, which involved occupation of country and pacification of the indigenous through military and other means. So from the very beginning of colonisation, military metaphors and means have been deployed to achieve control of unruly and insurrectionary spaces, and especially indigenous threats from the interior or the inland. This settler colonial mindset, combined with long-standing associations between locusts and warfare, to make the Australian War on Locusts a potent symbol of settler ambitions. Now, as James Scott points out, the nature of military threat requires clearly defined and easily monitored and patrolled state spaces. So I rely on Scott, excuse me, a little in interpreting particularly the latter part of this story. So as the potential extent of locust outbreak areas in the interior was increasingly recognised in the mid-20th century, so was the state's inability to monitor, let alone control, such vast areas. But from the 1970s, after 3 decades of almost uninterrupted engagement in warfare overseas, Australia was finally achieving the centralised control and increasingly the technological means to make the unruly inland a state space. As the ongoing locust threat suggests, however, this project is far from complete. So, let's start with the Bible. Now, I owe this one to Lil, who said, "No, you should talk about locusts in the Bible," and she was absolutely right. So the entanglement of locusts and warfare goes right back to, and perhaps beyond, biblical times in which locusts were one of the armies of God. So in Exodus, there's a locust plague unleashed by Moses when the Pharaoh won't let the Israelites go to worship the Lord. And this is intended to be a powerful symbol of God's power to be told among the Israelites for generations to come. So they had this incredible symbolic power. But in the book of Joel, one of the minor prophets, there's a fantastic description of an apocalyptic event involving a locust plague. And so I'll read a bit of the scripture for you. "The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but behind them a desolate wilderness and nothing escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like war horses they run, as with the rumbling of chariots they leap on the top of the mountains, like the crackling of a flame of fire, devouring the stubble, like a powerful army drawn up for battle. Before them peoples are in anguish, all faces grow pale. Like warriors they charge, like soldiers they scale the wall, they march each on his way, they do not swerve from their paths." So this is part of a story where God is kind of testing the people of Zion. "So when they assemble the congregation and pray to God, he has pity on them and relents, saying, 'I will restore to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army which I sent amongst you.'" So locusts in the Bible are the Lord's army and a potent symbol of his power, but they're very frequently represented in these highly militarised terms. Now, in Australia, of course, Aboriginal people had traditions around locusts and probably still do have traditions around locusts, but I've been able to find very little about these. Certainly the settlers, however, imposed their own ideas about these native insects. So in the first recorded locust plague in Australia in 1844, the language of war was evident. For example, thanks again, Trove, we have something from Jerry's Plains inland of Newcastle in December 1844. We have had a few remarkably cold days and nights which have operated like a Russian winter upon the invading armies of grasshoppers. There is now scarcely one to be seen. And again, you can see the terminology of grasshoppers and locusts was quite interchangeable. In the same year, when locusts fell upon the gardens and parklands of the infant settlement of Adelaide, It was suggested that the only effective remedy would be fire. Intriguingly, at this time, Aboriginal people in Adelaide said that they'd never seen locusts in such numbers, suggesting that even at this early stage, grazing and clearing in locust country had provided conditions that encouraged gregariousness and migration. The colonists hypothesised that Aboriginal burning regimes had previously kept the locusts in check, and as they ceased, the insects were able to proliferate. There were further locust plagues in the 1870s, 1888, 1891 and 1908, and these too were described using military terms. Landholders responded using fire. Down the bottom there you can see that they're getting to them by burning. So they used fire, ploughing up egg beds and with resignation. Some regarded them as a hazard they could do no more about than frost or hail, though into the 20th century, insecticides such as arsenic sprays were more widely deployed. Now, it was realised quite early that the locusts came from the inland. During a plague in 1928, retired New South Wales government entomologist Walter Froggatt, now he's the guy who said that cane toads would become a pest, declared his belief that locusts emerged in the western districts of New South Wales before making their way south and east into the agricultural districts. Though the collective noun for gregarious locusts is a swarm, even Froggatt referred to, quote, large armies of hungry locusts, although his language was otherwise fairly neutral. Now, following hot on the heels of the Great Depression, a really major outbreak occurred in 1934. And at this time, newspapers provided a blow-by-blow account of the distribution of the swarms and the damage incurred, as well as the success of countermeasures. Now, during this plague, the main strategy for combating the advancing swarms was to mix arsenic with bran and lay the baits in their path. Now, a special reporter for the Argus conveyed the excitement of tackling the insects. He said, quote, "An intense campaign of poisoning will be begun tomorrow morning when the volunteers will rush to the area, taking with them in motor trucks about 5 tonnes of poison, which will be mixed with bran and spread in front of the insects." So the language of war was widespread in the reporting. Things like uncultivated areas were attacked, there was an invading horde, a campaign of poisoning. Farmers met to discuss plans for an attack on the swarms of grasshoppers. However, this language wasn't ubiquitous and was tempered with the more neutral language of natural disaster. Now, poison baits were widely deployed, though some spoke out against this practice. For example, during the 1934 outbreak in the Mallee, Alec Chisholm, he of Mateship with Birds fame, cautioned against the widespread use of poisons, as this also killed the birds that preyed on the grasshoppers. Now, he declined to describe these as allies, so he didn't use this militarised language. Instead, he suggested that we needed more knowledge of where, why and how plague-scale outbreaks occurred. Similarly, James Barrett pointed to the way in which locust plagues can be checked by insectivorous birds, and he pointed to the examples of his own pet brolga, as well as the seagull monument in Utah, which was raised by the Mormons after the miracle of the seagulls that were sent to destroy a locust plague there. He finished with a call for more national parks, as James Barrett would, in order to preserve the balance of nature. So these advocates who saw nature as something to work with rather than against were, however, in the minority. Now, the 1934 plague highlighted the lack of understanding of locust habits and movement, and it really stimulated research on the locust by researchers from the Waite Institute in South Australia and in New South Wales and Queensland by CSIR in cooperation with the State Departments of Agriculture. And both teams emphasised the importance of the inland in outbreaks, and relevant areas were mapped. Locusts were also a focus of imperial research efforts, receiving top billing at an imperial entomological conference held in London in 1935, which is the subject of this newspaper article. The convener of the conference, Dr. Neave of the Imperial Institute of Entomology, declared that locusts were, quote, "man's only serious competitors for natural dominion. If man relaxed his war on insects, the latter would get the upper hand." So entomology obviously had a critical role in imperial as well as national dominion over nature. Meanwhile, in a world of increasing military unrest, a locust plague emerged in Queensland in 1937. And one of the most militaristic approaches to the subject, an article published in the SA Mail reported it thus: "Hopper plague in Queensland, war declared." And it went on to say, the Grasshopper Extermination Bill, rushed through Parliament a few days ago, was a formal declaration of war that has been raging for 3 weeks. All landholders whose properties are infested have been conscripted where they have not previously volunteered. So here the language of war is used to sort of describe and justify landholder obligations in the event of locust plague. 2 years later, Germany invaded Poland, triggering World War II. And I think this conflict, World War II, really played a key role in consolidating linkages between war on humans and war on insects, which was continued into the Cold War conflicts of the Korean War, the Malayan Emergency, and especially the Vietnam War. Now, several authors have written about the development and deployment of the organochlorine insecticides as part of the war effort. For example, as John Perkins has shown, DDT was a compound developed under wartime conditions in Switzerland, first to safeguard Swiss food supplies, and second to protect the Swiss from typhus brought in by refugees from the war zone. It was enthusiastically taken up by the US for food security reasons, as well as military health reasons as well. Now, while such pesticides also played an important role in the Australian context, and there's probably a lot more to be said about their role in linking military and capitalist networks, today I'm going to be focusing on the role of aviation, as well as more general approaches to organisation and strategy in defence and locust control. Now, the loss of HMS Prince of Wales and HMS Repulse to the Japanese off Malaya in December 1941 provided an early indicator of the importance of air power, which came to dominate the war in the Pacific. While the success of British long-range bombing campaigns against German cities were more controversial, I think to the population listening and watching from home, air power was seen as a really important, a really critical component of successful military strategy. But there were also other airborne dangers. Although it wasn't widely publicised at the time, malaria caused more Australian casualties than wounds in the Pacific theatre, and the ability of Australian troops to keep fighting in Papua was solely due to the acquisition and deployment of anti-malarial drugs and other mosquito control measures. So anti-malaria units were established within the Australian military, which undertook hand spraying with DDT, as we see on the left there, and physical destruction of mosquito breeding sites. And in 1945, RAAF Beaufort planes also began to spray DDT in New Guinea, New Britain and Bougainville in order to protect troops. Now, while DDT was ineffective against locusts, in the context of the broader significance of air power in the Pacific War, as we shall see, this activity of controlling mosquitoes using aeroplanes certainly made an impression on Australian farmers. Now, in Australia in the 1940s, the insecticide of choice for locust control was BHC or benzene hexachloride, otherwise known as gamexane or lindane. Now, gamexane was one of the new organochlorine pesticides, insecticides developed during the Second World War, and it was inspired by the example of DDT. Gamexane is a potent neurotoxin and a likely carcinogen. It's also persistent in the environment, although it's got a half-life of about 15 months in soil, so it's not as persistent as DDT and some of the other organochlorines. It is, however, highly toxic to fish and bees, and it causes eggshell thinning in birds, as the organochlorines do. And an international ban on its agricultural use was implemented in 2009 under the Stockholm Convention on POPs, or persistent organic pollutants. So it's quite nasty stuff. In spring 1945, an RAAF aircraft equipped for DDT anti-mosquito spraying was used to treat a Rutherglen bug outbreak, which threatened to destroy the stone fruit crop in northern Victoria. Now, after the Rutherglen bug had been dealt with, attention turned to the locusts, which were unusually prevalent in the Mallee during that season, the Victorian Mallee. Now, the equipment and techniques used for spraying mosquitoes during the Pacific War were found unsuitable for these agricultural purposes, but the CSIRO and the RAAF worked together to modify the aircraft and the approach that they used to achieve better results against the locust and the Rutherglen bug. To find the best carrier for the pesticide in solution, they sought the assistance of the Chemical Warfare Section of the Munitions Supply Laboratories. Now, I actually didn't realise we had a Chemical Warfare Section here, but apparently we did. Tests showed that diesel made the best and most effective carrier solution, so they sprayed gamexane in diesel over mixed into diesel. After a further process of field experimentation and modification, satisfactory results were achieved. And the results were written up in an article for the Journal of Agriculture Victoria, jointly authored by the Ag Department senior entomologist and the RAAF flight lieutenant who led the operation. So in 1946, further testing of aerial applications of insecticide was contemplated, but events were overtaken by the discovery of a concentration of locust egg beds in the Mallee. And the Victorian Ag Department approached the RAAF to see whether these aircraft and a suitable number of crew from the Laverton Air Base could assist in preventive spraying. Now, while there was already the one aircraft that they'd used against the Rutherglen bug and the locust outbreak previously, the Ag Department wanted more. So the RAAF had to get some planes out of storage. They'd been used in the Pacific War and they needed reconditioning and considerable work and modification. But the RAAF set about this work and they made a total of four aircraft available. So the anti-grasshopper operations in the Mallee using the RAAF planes to spray gamexane commenced in October 1946. Now, the squadron leader reported that the work was highly successful and of great value to the agriculturalists. The modification which resulted from the test should make a great big improvement to our anti-mosquito technique should it be necessary to again undertake such work. And he predicted that the spraying would continue for several weeks, as it did. And the aircraft would also assist with a cutworm plague in the flax crops. Handy. He noted that RAAF capacity to spray insecticides should also be maintained to protect personnel who were still stationed in New Guinea and New Britain, as well as those on exercises in remote island areas. However, he continued that the RAAF was attempting to dispose of all of its Beaufort aircraft and wondered whether it might be best to encourage a civil agency to take over this task and then contract to the Air Force as required. So you can see there's these very detailed and complex linkages between the war on pests, the war on locusts, the war on mosquitoes, and military objectives. When in November 1946, the Ag Department asked for more resources to extend the spraying campaign, the RAAF replied that a manpower shortage made this impossible, but committed to the current level of support for as long as possible. They also proposed that Mustang aircraft might be used to spray locusts as part of pilot training exercises. So again, locust control is thoroughly entangled with these military objectives. Now in 1948, the New South Wales Agriculture Department published a brochure on recent developments in grasshopper control in which they recommended the use of improved bran baits using gamexane. But they also noted that farmers were really resistant to carrying out this baiting, and they attributed this resistance to, quote, widely publicised accounts of aircraft distribution of DDT in the wartime malaria control campaign. And a similar trend was apparently evident in the USA as well. Farmers were completely captivated by the idea that we could use aeroplanes in this way to completely wipe out pests. In 1950, as another locust plague emerged in the Mallee, the Victorian Department of Agriculture again sought the assistance of the RAAF. And when they were told that the RAAF wasn't in a position to assist, the Premier of Victoria, Jack Macdonald, wrote to Prime Minister Robert Menzies to ask whether he could get the Air Force to cooperate by providing three Dakotas. The RAAF, however, really couldn't spare the aircraft, I don't know, perhaps because of the Korean War, which had broken out by this stage, but again did assist by providing spraying equipment and a tanker and radio equipment and ground staff and so on. So the DC-3 aircraft were provided by Qantas Empire Airways and Australian National Airways. I can't imagine a DC-3 engaging in spraying, but apparently they did. In an operation that materially, as well as conceptually, combined the civil and military. So at this point, responses to locusts were still organised as responses to imminent threats as they emerged. The focus was on defending the agricultural areas, and there was no systematic strategy for forward surveillance and control. But a more coordinated approach was proposed at a conference of technical officers convened by CSIR in May 1947. Now, this meeting recommended that a trial control campaign using a new strategy of outbreak suppression should be carried out in the Bogan-Macquarie area of central New South Wales. A basic principle of this strategy was that the whole campaign should be carefully planned and completely controlled throughout and financed by all of the governments concerned. However, the plan was delayed in consultations about the cost among the premiers and ministers for agriculture. It was revived at a similar conference in 1949, but the Premier of Victoria wouldn't commit to the scheme on the scale proposed. Now, the summer of 1952-53 saw a major outbreak starting in western New South Wales, which proceeded south. And it was purported that, quote, The Victorian Department of Agriculture cooperated, or this was, it was later reported in retrospect, that the Victorian Department of Agriculture cooperated by attacking swarms in southern New South Wales to prevent the invasion of Victoria over the Murray River. The campaign involved 29 days of constant spraying, aerial spraying of organochlorines using both RAAF and TAA planes, both charging the state for their services, with the RAAF charging about half of what TAA charged. Now, this prompted yet another conference to discuss the possibility of coordinated early control, and this was held in Canberra in May 1954. And one of the key questions raised in light of the 1952-3 experience was whether it was better to attempt to control grasshopper plagues by the present conventional methods or by attacking the primary outbreak areas. Now, while there was some enthusiasm for further research on outbreak areas and a general consensus emerged that plagues came from the interior, there were doubts about the feasibility of outbreak suppression, and a key issue was organisation. So the minutes of these meetings, or the minutes of this particular meeting, are captured in a publication in the National Library. And there, Dr. Ken Key, who was the principal research officer with the Division of Entomology at CSIRO, said, quote, "A campaign against the plague locust needed the same kind of organisation as a military campaign, or that used in fire control." And the CSIRO head of entomology, Dr. Nicholson, likewise suggested that what was needed was, quote, "complete control over the organisation of the campaign on a quasi-military basis." He suggested that an officer be appointed to patrol likely outbreak areas so the treatment could be applied as swarms were beginning to migrate from the outbreak area before they reached the agricultural zone. Ultimately, the conference recommended that this patrol officer should be appointed and that a trial be conducted of this strategy of outbreak suppression, involving an intensive campaign that demanded a much more intensive attack and control organisation, and these are the terms in which it is described. The trial should be carried out as a joint Commonwealth-state operation at a time that's likely to provide an evaluation of the technical feasibility and economic practicality of the strategy. It would involve a highly developed intelligence service to be able to locate all swarms in or near the outbreak area, and there would also be a military-style structure with labour working in gangs under the supervision of field officers, who in turn would be under the direction of entomologists. And relevant equipment and materials were to be kept on hand for rapid deployment. Now, Queensland was slightly indifferent to this plan, and Victoria dissented. As the state with the least interior land, it continued to adopt a defensive position, remaining more concerned with crop protection than with swarm destruction. So in 1955, this recommendation went to the Australian Agricultural Council and was approved. Now, the authorisation occurred at the end of a major plague, but also it also took place in the context of a military conflict to the near north of Australia, the Malayan Emergency. Now, the Malayan government had responded slowly to the threat posed by communist guerrillas, but in the early 1950s, conflict had escalated rapidly. In 1954, Australia was involved in a joint exercise called Operation Termite, and again, note the link with invertebrates, in which a combined air and ground assault destroyed 181 communist camps. Further Australian troops were committed in October 1955. Now, here was a model for addressing the locust problem in Australia. You pinpoint the enemy through careful surveillance, and then you destroy them in a decisive, coordinated joint action to prevent proliferation and counterattack. However, after the successes of 1954-55, Australian troops in Malaya were largely responsible for a long mopping up campaign involving extensive patrolling, watching for contacts in rubber plantations, and guarding the new villages. Troops rarely encountered communists, leading to frustration and tension. In an ambush in 1956, for example, the Australians killed two communists but lost three of their own troops in an ambush. So this kind of engagement, I think, highlighted the difficulty of maintaining a controlled state space in a hostile environment. Now, back in Australia, the trial locust campaign was planned for 1958, but a 1959 meeting decided against it. Boris Uvarov, who was a leading international locust researcher and head of the British Anti-Locust Research Centre from 1929 to 1966, so, you know, this guy was Mr. Locust, he attended the Trial Campaign Management Committee's meeting in November 1959. And there he suggested that a trial on a single outbreak area in 1 year would not likely be successful. Rather, what was required was a dedicated and coordinated body to launch a large-scale offensive strategy against emerging locust threats. So in light of these comments and the absence of a present plague threat, the committee abandoned their plans for the outbreak suppression trial and instead recommended a policy of continual monitoring pending the establishment of an interstate locust organisation to lead monitoring and control efforts. Now, I think Uvarov was doubtless an influential character here, but I'm arguing that broader ideas about the nature of conflict also influenced decision making. So as Australians engaged in a drawn-out, frustrating and often fruitless campaign against an invisible and sparse enemy in the jungles of Malaya, in the absence of a major locust threat, enthusiasm diminished for a small-scale intervention that was unlikely to produce immediate and conclusive victory over the locust hordes. Now, more locust control meetings were held during the 1960s, but the status quo was maintained in the absence of major locust activity, and it took another plague in 1973-74 to spur further action. In the meantime, research continued, and I can see we're going to run out of time, so I'll cut it a bit short. At this time, they conducted some detailed research in the interior, in southwest Queensland in particular, using regular transects to mark locust habitat. Also, they discovered that locusts would migrate at night, which was something they hadn't realised before and solved. One of the key problems of how the locusts got from these fairly isolated arid inland areas into the agricultural belt. But at the same time, Australian troops were deployed in the jungles of Vietnam, engaged in search and destroy missions against the Viet Cong. Now, James Scott has characterised the widespread use of Agent Orange in Vietnam as one example of the unprecedented efforts to reclaim non-state space for the state during that war. So defoliating large sections of forest, for example, was intended to render it legible and safe for government forces. And I think there are perhaps resonances here with the work of locust researchers who were making the interior and its desert denizens known. Now, after Vietnam, the incoming ALP government in 1972 implemented the Defence of Australia policy, focusing on defending continental Australia against external attack rather than military objectives outside Australian territory. And the emphasis here was on surveillance and on local agile strike capacity. And this would lead to the establishment of constant patrols by units in the north of Australia, as well as over the horizon radar. And here again, there are resonances in locust control. The patrols followed the lead in some ways established by the Agricultural Council in conducting surveillance for locust outbreaks, while from the 1980s, entomological radar would be deployed in locust research and control operations. Now, 1973 saw the advent of a major locust plague, the first for 20 years, which affected agricultural areas in New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia and Victoria. In October 1973, the New South Wales government approached the Commonwealth for assistance to combat the locusts. In response, the Minister for Defence provided 4 army aircraft, Sioux helicopters, soldiers, you name it. Now, there's some footage there, but we're running short of time, so I won't play it. Queensland also appealed to the federal government for assistance, and in April 1974, the army was sent in with misting units mounted on Land Rovers to fight a locust war, as it was reported, over a 160-kilometre radius from Emerald. So again, this is the old anti-locust strategy of defensive action against a hostile invader, implemented using actual military personnel and equipment. Now, I go on to argue that at this time there was a convergence in organisational thinking between the military and agricultural. The experience of Vietnam suggested that the division of the Australian Defence Force into Army, Air Force and Navy had hindered our efforts in Vietnam. So there were calls to consolidate them into one single defence force. That was argued in 1973 and implemented in 1976. And at the same time, the Australian Plague Locust Commission was established. Now, this had been first envisaged in the early 1950s, and it became operational in 1976. So when it became operational, the capacity to adopt this idea of outbreak suppression was finally available, as was a military framework for it. While continuing to defend the agricultural lands against invading locust armies, the Australian Plague Locust Commission would coordinate surveillance and undertake rapid mobile strikes on swarming events in the arid locust heartland. So this was guerrilla warfare, and the Viet Cong had shown us the importance of environmental knowledge, surveillance, preparedness and mobility in maintaining control of territory. So this suppression strategy had been around for a long time, but it was only in the 1970s, I think, after we'd been through Vietnam, we had changing paradigms of warfare becoming dominant, and I think that that played a role in legitimising and operationalising this strategy. Okay, although conventional spraying still took place in major outbreak years, this surveillance and rapid strike model came to be the dominant approach to locusts in subsequent decades as research increased and understanding of the conditions under which locusts became gregarious and migrated from the arid interior. Australia played a leading role in developing a biological control agent based on the Metarhizum acridium fungus, but it's possible to say that this had something to do with Australia's involvement in the Gulf War or Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, where chemical and biological weapons were really big, but I think that it's just really a response to the growth of organic farming and the awareness of environmental sensitivity to conventional pesticides, so it's not all about the military. However, the linkages between war and locust control continued in the light of the September 11 attacks and Bali bombings of 2002, of course. In 2002, we have the launch of the anti-terrorism campaign in Australia with the slogan, Be Alert, Not Alarmed. And this seeks to enrol all Australian civilians in the fight against terrorism by reporting suspicious activity to a central hotline. And we can see very much that language reflected in this brochure issued by the New South Wales Department of Agriculture in 2004. Now, securing landholder assistance had been a key problem for organisations seeking to control locusts, in spite of the passage of various noxious insect acts from the 1930s that required landholders to treat locust infestations on their properties. So I think it's not surprising that we see this kind of language that's also being used to mobilise civilians against the perceived terrorist threat being used in relation to locusts. And of course, the strategic shift evident here is from conscription to counterinsurgency. Another major outbreak occurred in 2010, and the reporting again mirrored the language of conventional warfare. Whoops. But we also see a rather less combative or more adaptive response reflected in this rather pragmatic billboard erected in the Victorian Mallee in 2010. There's a few other resonances as well. In April 2015, the US Office of Naval Research announced that its low-cost UAV swarming technology program, and I'm sorry for the quality of that photo, but those are swarming drones, had been developed, and the program acronym was LOCUST. Now, the Australian Plague Locust Commission in 2016 vetoed the use of drones for aerial surveillance and surveying because officers on board the survey planes make all kinds of decisions at the time and they need people there. But a researcher at the University of Adelaide is using drones in order to study locusts, so watch this space. To conclude, Rob Nugent, in his 2010 ethnographic film Memoirs of a Plague, which investigated human responses to locusts in various global contexts, argues that our reactions to the natural phenomenon of locusts may arise from long-held prejudices and myths rather than the reality of the threat they pose. Now, while it's debatable that locust plagues in Australia are natural rather than a legacy of settler colonial land modification, I've attempted to show in a similar vein that responses to locusts have been shaped to a great extent, or at least to some extent, by evolving conceptual and material linkages between locusts and warfare. In settler colonial Australia, the biblical significance of locust plagues was stripped of its meaning. No longer a symbol of God's power, only the notion of locusts as a military opponent remained. If sheep were the shock troops of empire, locusts were increasingly seen as the wingmen of indigenous resistance, an unpredictable and mobile inland corps whose irregular incursions into settler territory were deeply unsettling. To control the locust was not only to defend the occupied pastoral and agricultural territory, but also to master the unruly inland, making it a state space that was known, patrolled, and amenable to central control. The changing nature of responses owed much to prevailing military technology and ideas about military strategy. The ongoing war on locusts highlights the entanglement of war on humans and war on nature as a key element of modernity. And thank you very much to all those people who provided pictures, and thank you everybody for coming along and listening.